This presentation is brought to you by iawaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Tonight Shir, which is the eighth commandment, and having learned 2 weeks ago how to murder legitimately, and last week how to commit adultery legitimately, tonight we're going to learn how to steal legitimately in the eighth commandment, which is Lo Signov, thou shalt not steal. We're going to deal with this commandment in the three ways that we dealt with the last two. And that is, the first way is considering the matrix that the Ten Commandments is. You'll remember that it's written and formatted in such a way that it can be read vertically, as is the normal way of reading it, and it can be read horizontally across the line. And the it's necessary, in order to be able to understand the relationship between the commandments and their meaning, to learn them both vertically and horizontally. So we will be doing that. We'll be looking at Lo Signov, the eighth commandment, thou shalt not steal, from the perspective of its position in the vertical reading of the commandments and in the lateral reading of the commandments. It's placed next to the third commandment, is that right? The third and the eighth. The third commandment being Lo Sisso, thou shalt not take God's name in vain. And alongside that commandment is the commandment of Lo Signov, thou shalt not steal. And the third thing we'll look at is the Ta'amim, the Zohar's focus on the trope, on the phrasing used in the Shavuos laning of the Ten Commandments, because that phrasing is the most revealing about the deeper meaning of the Ten Commandments. First, let's look at the vertical reading. Vertical reading, the Ten Commandments finds itself at the second column. Makes sense. Second column deals with interhuman issues. That's where not stealing should be. And it's third in a line of Lo Tirtzach, Lo Tinach, and then Lo Signov. Thou shalt not murder, thou shalt not commit adultery. And I think it's important for those of you who were at last week's shiur, I think a lot of difficulty with that shiur will be resolved if you understand that adultery is an incorrect translation for the term tinach. And this will have bearing on our shiur today as well. Let's go through them all, starting from Lo Tirtzach. Are there chairs available there? There's one simple way to fill the house: a shiur on sex and mysticism, and the next shiur is fine. Lo Tirtzach is not thou shalt not murder. Lo Tirtzach is thou shalt not take human life. Because murder implies a specific type of taking human life which is never permitted. And we learnt 2 weeks ago that Lo Tirtzach can be read Lo Tirtzach. No, thou shalt murder. Well, that doesn't mean thou shalt murder. So we obviously have to translate Tirtzach not as murder, but as there are situations in which thou shalt take life, such as in self-defense, such as in military combat, such as in capital punishment. There are situations in which thou shalt take life. So Lo Tirtzach. And if we translate the word Tirtzach as taking life rather than murder, it's a little bit easier to understand. Similarly, Lo Tinach does not mean thou shalt not commit adultery, because then the Zohar wouldn't make any sense. What does it mean? Sometimes Tinach, you shall commit adultery. No, you can never commit adultery. So what does Lo Tinach mean? So the correct translation, therefore, of Lo Tinach would be unrestricted sexual activity. And Lo Tinach means thou shalt not have unrestricted sexual activity. Lo, however, no. Tinach, you shall have unrestricted sexual activity. How do you put the two together? If the lack of restriction refers to the variety of people with whom you engage, that's Lo. You may not do that. But if the lack of restriction refers to the innovativeness and the free expression of a relationship between a man and his wife, that's tinaf. There should be an unrestricted relationship. That's what the word tinaf really means. And likewise, in Lois Signov, we're going to have to translate what exactly does Lois Signov mean, because we're going to use the same comment of the Zohar to say, Loim, no, but sometimes tignov, sometimes you must steal. What does that mean? How do you do that? Why do you do that? So looking at the context of it, what's important is understanding why Loim tignov comes after those, the previous three, and what the relationship is. And here we have the Gemara in Sanhedrin, which Rashi quotes in part, and Daf Pei Vav in Sanhedrin, where the Gemara says, Tanu Rabban, we learned in a brisa, Lo Tignov, this eighth commandment, thou shalt not steal, Begoinev Nefoshus Hakosuv Medaber. The Torah is talking not about theft of money or property, the Torah is talking about kidnapping, about theft of people. That's what it means. How do you know that it is in fact talking about kidnapping? And the term used for kidnapping in the Gemara is gonev nefoshes, the theft of lives, the theft of souls. How do I know that it's talking about kidnapping and not the theft of money? Unless you say tseulamad mishloshes remidus shatur nidreshes for him. When there are more than one possible interpretations of a phrase in the Torah, then we have to use one or more of the 13 methods of extrapolation that God gave to Moshe on Sinai. Those are called the Shlosh Esrei Midos. There are 13 methods of extrapolation, 13 methods of logic, that you can clarify ambiguity in the Torah. You don't use those 13 principles when there is no ambiguity. But when there is ambiguity, you use the 13 principles. What are one of the 13 principles? One of them is Dovar Halomid Minyono. You look at context. So you say, Lo Signo could mean you shall not kidnap, and Lo Signo could mean you shall not steal. What is that? What is the vertical alignment of these commandments? Benefoshes, we're talking about capital offenses. Murder is a capital offense. Adultery is a capital offense. Therefore, Lo Signov is not a mandatory, it's not a civil issue. Lo Signov must also be a capital offense, and the only theft which is punishable by death is kidnapping. And that's important. The Torah punishes kidnapping by death. And therefore, since the first three in that column are dealing with a capital offense, clearly the third one is two, and Lo Signov must therefore mean thou shalt not kidnap. The Sipruna again, now you remember the Sipruna was the same person who said last week that Lo Sinat doesn't only mean adultery, it means all forbidden relations. The same authority, the Sipruna again says, Bichlau Genevo, Genevas Nefoshes, included in theft is kidnapping, Genevas Momon, theft, Genevas Das, Abrius, and deception. Those are three different areas in which the law of Geneva applies, the theft applies. Afapishi Ikar Hazod are Genevas Nefoshes, even though the root of this prohibition in the Ten Commandments is kidnapping. But it extends beyond that. In the same way, the root of the prohibition in last week's commandment was adultery. But it extended beyond that to all forbidden relationships. So here too, the core of it is kidnapping, because that's the capital offense. But it extends, the reach of the prohibition goes far beyond that. It goes to financial, to material theft, and it goes to deception, to intellectual theft. The theft of a person's ideas and a person's knowledge and information. What then is the common denominator between these three areas of theft? In the English language, we use different words for them. One is kidnapping, one is theft, and one is deception. And we don't use the word theft. People won't know what you're talking about if you say, that there was a person was stolen. What do you mean? Somebody stole something from the person? You say the person was kidnapped. You don't say a person's mind was stolen, you say he was deceived. So in English we don't acknowledge any kind of connection between these three concepts. And in the Torah they're the same moral concept. Kidnapping, theft, and deception at their root have the same principle. That's what's important to understand here. This is not just saying the word theft can mean many things, and it means all of them. No, it means one thing. And included in that umbrella one thing is a whole lot of specific details. And what is that one thing? If we're going to translate Geneva as theft, then we're not going to include kidnapping and deception. If we're going to translate it as kidnapping, we're not going to include theft and deception. What is the definition of this term Geneva? Just as we redefined the word Tinoch to say Tinoch does not mean adultery. Tinoch means something more than adultery. Tirzach does not mean murder, it means something more than murder. So Loisigma does not mean theft, it means something more than theft. What does it mean? And we would have to say that in order to understand the soul of the meaning of the word theft, we should look at the cardinal act of theft. And the cardinal act of theft is kidnapping. So what is there about kidnapping that the Torah prohibits and extends to property and intellect? I would suggest that with kidnapping, what you're doing is restricting a person's freedom of movement. You're imposing limitations on a person's ability to use his own body. Undeserved restriction on an innocent person. Because we're put here for one reason only, and that is to use our bodies and our other assets to implement God's will. To make a difference. To have some form of impact on the world around us. We're free to choose what impact. We're free to choose when, how. But we're not really free to opt out of making impact. And God gives us everything we need to make a difference. And it's very interesting that when we probe in our work, when we probe what people want most in their work, the word that keeps on coming up over and over and over again is not money. And it's not satisfaction. And it's not job fulfillment. The word that keeps on coming up over and over again is to make a difference. People want to make a difference. Has anybody ever looked through you as if you don't exist? Not ignored you, but there's something worse than ignoring you. Somebody can actually look through you as with a hazy kind of look as if they're not seeing you. And that doesn't feel good. People don't like to be irrelevant. There's almost nothing worse than a sense of irrelevance. But to be relevant, you've got to do something. You can't sit there and say, I want to be relevant. To be relevant, you have to make a relevant impact. To be relevant, you have to make a difference in a way that people consider is relevant and important. You can't be off on your own agenda. If you're off on your own agenda, you might be irrelevant. You think you're making a contribution, but it doesn't mean it's a relevant contribution. And there is a very deep and powerful desire in people to be relevant, to be making a difference. And when you kidnap somebody, you deprive them of the opportunity of making a difference. You deprive them of the opportunity of impact. You deprive them of the most important thing for which they've been put here, and that's to make a difference. And what about when you steal their property? The same. Because God gives us things for one of two reasons. God gives us things sometimes to reward us. And that's not a good situation. When God gives us material things to reward us, God is basically saying, you have chosen your currency. In your life, matter is more important than spirit, and so you would value material reward more than spiritual reward. So here it is. Take it. So we're not terribly enthused at the thought of getting material reward in this world. There's another reason for which God gives us material things, and that's so that we can use it for greater impact. And we have to be able to distinguish whether the material that we have is given to us. There are three possibilities. The Medrash says there's such a thing as grabbing material wealth that isn't yours. A person can be wealthy and it's not from God. Don't think that everybody's wealth comes from God. It's true. We say on Rosh Hashanah that God determines everybody's wealth, but that doesn't mean that you can't grab something which isn't yours. And sometimes a person's wealth is not a gift of God. Sometimes it is a gift of God and it's reward. Sometimes it's a gift of God and that's not good. The best is when it's a gift of God as tools, as instruments you need in order to make a contribution. And so if I've been given tools and somebody takes something away, that's like taking the toolbox away from a workman. It's a terrible thing. You make him, you cause him to be unable to impact it, to function in his area of work, because you've taken his tools away. And whether you kidnap a person or you take his things away, if we understand why people are given things, then you are restricting his freedom by taking even one of his tools away, because God doesn't give him anything he doesn't need. And if a person is given wealth, or he's given property, or he's given objects, or whatever it is, those are things he needs to make impact. And if you take one of those things away from him, you've taken away one of the tools he needs to be able to impact on his environment. And that's a restriction of a person's capacity to impact. And what else does a person use to impact? He uses his body to be mobile, to express himself, and he uses his material assets in whatever way his work demands, and he uses information. He uses his knowledge. When you deceive a person, you're taking information away from him. And again, impact, you're restricting his capacity to impact by limiting the information to which he has access, and sometimes substituting false information instead of true information in that person. And so, geneva, whether it's genevas nefoshos, genevas momon, or genevas das, whether it's the theft of people, kidnapping, the theft of money, or deception, in all cases, one is playing God. You are limiting, you are restricting a person's capacity to operate freely, you're restricting a person's capacity to make impact, to do God's will in the world, and that's very, very serious. There is a capital dimension to it. It's not just to say kidnapping, there's capital punishment for. The rest there isn't. That's not how to understand this. The way to understand this is that geneva has a capital dimension. The capital dimension is implemented when it's kidnapping. It manifests in different forms of consequence when it's something else. But geneva generally has a capital element to it. It's not a different prohibition. Then we would use a different term, and would be found in a different place. The fact that, as the Sifurnu says, this one term is used for all, and this one instruction, this one mitzvah, is used to cover both kidnapping and deception and theft, means that the capital nature of kidnapping transcends, at least philosophically, into the other areas too, and that there is an element of capital offense even in those other areas. Intellectual theft is not only deceit, but intellectual theft is also, if one contravenes the principle in Pirkei Avos lists 48 different ways, different activities needed to master the Torah. And one of those activities is Ha'omer Dovo B'Shem Omroi, that when you repeat something, you repeat it in somebody's name, that you credit the originator of an idea when you use that idea. And that's a very, very important principle. And in fact, we're told that if you don't do that, if you do that, you hasten Mashiach's coming. Which means if you don't do that, you're distancing Mashiach's coming. But more than that, it's an element of theft. And why that is interesting. It's worked out from a number of areas, but one of the interesting ones is an idea that Reb Shimon Shkop develops. Reb Shimon Shkop is a recent authority. He was my teacher's teacher. And he explores what the basis is for one of the forms of nezek, of damage. So there are different forms. All damage that a person causes is classified into three areas. There's shor, that's the ox, and there are all different forms of ox. Means it's your motor car, it can be your animals, it can be your dog, it can be all sorts of things. And he can damage with his horn, and he can damage by eating, and he can damage by trampling. There are all sorts of forms of damage that fit into the ox. The second area of damage is fire, and that would include weapons and things like that. Is it using a gun, using fire, using bombing, energy, any form of energy. And then, apart from Adam himself, apart from the man himself, and then there's one called bor. You dig a hole, you put a stumbling block somewhere, and somebody that gets damaged in the process. And maybe the hole doesn't belong to you. A hole wouldn't belong to you. A hole is nothing. A hole is an absence of ground. And maybe it's not in your territory. you did it in the Rishus HaRabim. So you dig a hole in the public domain. On what basis, Rav Shimon Shkop explores, does the damage accrue to you? It's not your hole. It's the day. You might be accused of doing something, but then it's indirect damage. Then you created a stumbling block, and somebody else stumbled on the stumbling block that you created. It's not your damage. Then it's you with an indirect damage. It's Gromer. It's something else altogether. And Rav Shimon explains that the creator of a of an idea or of a thing is its owner. That when you've created something, not only are you the creator of it, but you are the owner of it. And therefore, by creating a pit, it's not that you did an action which caused somebody else damage. Somebody was damaged by an object, in this case the pit, that belongs to you, which is no different to somebody being damaged by your dog or by your ox. He was damaged by your pit. Why is it your pit? Because you made it. And something you make is yours. And the idea is developed from there, and therefore an idea that I create is mine. And that's the origin of one of the origins of the concept of intellectual property. That when a person has created something, it belongs to him. And one has to then ask, in that case, why would disseminating that idea constitute theft in terms of our definition of theft? What did we say Geneva meant? Geneva meant restricting the capacity of an individual to impact. So if I take his body, or I take his property, or I deceive him, I take his information, I am limiting, I am restricting his ability to impact. What about intellectual property? If somebody merely uses one of my ideas without crediting me, in what way is it limiting my ability to impact? Well, it's limiting it very much. Because there are two ways that you can destroy value. The one way that you can destroy value is by damaging something. Take something valuable and take some of it away. And you've got damage. You've got less than you had before. But in the area of intellectual property and certain other areas, you create damage by duplicating. Because the more you duplicate, the less valuable it is. The more supply there is. So just as one wouldn't think of damaging another person by taking something of his, by disseminating something of his, one is damaging him just the same. Because next time he uses it, it has less impact. People say, yeah, I've heard that one before. As we've seen, that as has happened with humor and other things, with the internet, isn't it? You can't tell a joke anymore. You tell a joke, the chances are, people have read it, people are sick of it before you've even had a chance to enjoy it with anybody. Disseminating something, an idea widely, does a lot for people, but damages the originator. And this is the whole question now of being able to download music from the web and being able to download. This is the whole issue. There was a court case recently, was there not? I think the Supreme Court is waiting to hear it about the website from which you can download music and copy it onto CDs. And everybody say the one argument is, this is great for the world. And that's just the way it goes. And so you can disseminate and everybody can access this music and it's a wonderful thing. Yes, it's a wonderful thing for the world and it's a bad thing for the originator. And we have to protect the originator because he's the owner. And as the owner, he has rights not to disseminate. He has rights to hold on to it if he chooses. He has rights to disseminate it only under certain conditions. And to creating a situation where dissemination is not controlled is problematic, and I don't know how they're going to control it ultimately on the internet. But certainly from the moral perspective, an individual has to understand that he is not entitled to utilize an idea of another person outside of the bounds that person has placed on the utilization of that idea. So if somebody says this may not be Xeroxed or photocopied, then he's placing a condition. He's saying, this is my idea, I created it. You may use it on certain conditions, that you don't Xerox it, that you don't sell it, that you don't do this, that you don't do that. You have to respect that, because he's the creator of the idea. Morally, we have to respect it. And if we don't, that's called Gnevas Dvorim. You're stealing ideas, and that falls partly into the category of Gneva, which is theft, which is the eighth commandment, which has a capital element to it. Doesn't mean you're going to be hanged for it, or electrocuted for it. But it does mean that one is involved in an area of offense, of moral offense, that the Torah views with enormous seriousness, the area of Geneva. How far does this prohibition of theft go? and to learn a piece of Mesillas Yeshorim with you. Mesillas Yeshorim, as some of you know, is one of the three classical Musar Seforim, books on works on Jewish morality and how that operates. And it was written by Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, an Italian authority, and was one of the three very, very great works. When the Vilna Gaon died, they found next to his bed a Tanakh and a Mesillas Yeshorim, because he used to say, from Tanakh, when I read through the Tanakh, I can think of every piece of Talmud, of every word in the Gemara, because it all links back to the Tanakh somehow. So as I read through the pages of the Tanakh, it all comes back to me. I can remember everything as I read through the pages of the Tanakh. But the Mesillas Yeshorim isn't there. That's a different work. This is something over and above the Tanakh that one has to know, and that one has to read, and that one has to study. And he says, among many other things, the following. He quotes a Gemara in Chagiga that says, Gezel v'aroyus nafshesh of odom mechamdetan u'misaveloi. That theft and sexual immorality are areas that people are very attached to, and they crave it. And he says, in Anachnu Ruim we see, she'afal pi she'lo rov b'nei ha'odom ganovim begolihem. Most people are not thieves. What does it mean? Most people have a problem with theft. Most people aren't thieves. But that means, Dainush yishtuchu yad mamash b'momen chavreihem lakachas v'losim b'kileihem. That means they won't put their hands in somebody else's till and take out money and put it in their pockets. If that's how you want to define theft, then most of us aren't thieves. Nevertheless, Rubam tuamim tam geneva b'masom v'matonim. Most people taste the flavor of theft in their daily business activities. B'mashe yoru heter la'atzmon, by making allowances for themselves, lehistaker ish behefseido shel chaveroi v'yomru lahaviach shani. Where one man feels it is legitimate to make a profit at the expense of another man, and calls it normal business practice. It's not okay. One has to make a profit, but not at the expense of somebody else. And there are many prohibitions with theft. It's not only the Ten Commandments, and he lists many of them. Ubichlali surim rabim. And there are many prohibitions involved in this. Because it is not only the open and obvious oppression of another human being that is theft. Any action which will ultimately cause the loss of another person is theft. And he gives certain examples. For example, the Gemara in Sanhedrin says about this, Eshes Re'ehu Lo'timo, praising a person who has never had relations with the wife of his friend. What kind of praise is that? That's normal, bottom level decency. Says the Gemara, it doesn't mean that. Min shelo yorad l'umonos chaveiro. A person who has not entered the competitive field of his friend. Now there are laws that govern competition, what we can and cannot do, but it's not a free-for-all. It is a free market, but it's not a free-for-all. There are laws that govern under what conditions one can enter into competition. If a person has carved out a niche for himself, there are situations in which you may enter and compete, and there are situations in which you may not enter and compete. And those laws, if one neglects those laws, one is stealing. How many people here have studied the laws of competition? My hand is not up either, because I don't know those laws well either. But should we be in business if we don't know those laws? How can we be? What does it mean? That it's not important to us. We accept what normal business practice is okay. It isn't okay necessarily. There are laws of theft that go far beyond theft. Laws of competition. How we may compete, under what circumstances we may compete. There's a discussion in the Gemara of Matzia as to whether a retailer can give candies to children, to encourage the children to bring the mothers to his store. and there's a view that forbids it. It's that's unfair competition. Compete on the basis of the quality and the cost of your goods. Don't use all sorts of other things to get people in. The Gemara concludes that you may do that for one reason only, and that is it's easy enough for your competition to do the same. Which implies that if you do anything that your competition cannot easily do, you're not permitted to use that as a form of marketing. So with your commercial strength, if using your commercial strength you can bulk buy and you can bring lower prices to the consumer, that's great, that's fine. But to use your commercial strength to get some other side benefit that your competitor can't meet, that wouldn't be fine. A worker, according to the Gemara, does not have to make a motzi. He does not have to wash and make a motzi. Are you getting a whiskey there? Are you getting a scotch or a glass of water, Elio? Are you getting a scotch? Are you offering refreshments to everybody, or are you just taking a glass of water for yourself at the moment? Even to a person who's working, who's an employee, to stop his work in order to go and wash, to make a motzi, no, don't have to make a motzi. When he's benching, he becomes very frum. You know, if he's at home and he's benching and he's going to be late for the movies, he stops at Al Yechasreinu. He stops halfway through the benching. When he's at work, and he's just had his sandwiches, he's very frum and he benches slowly and he goes till the very end. No, you're not allowed to. When you're working on somebody else's time, you stop the benching right after the first brokers. Even if it's time to say Kriya Shema, if you started working before dawn and you're going to be working through the time of saying Shema, you only say the first paragraph. How much more so, says the Mesilas Yeshorim, how much more so? The Divrei HaRishus. To do things that are permitted, not obligated. If you're not allowed to do the things you have to do because you're taking time from your employer, certainly you can't do the things that you don't have to do. Shechol Tzchir Yoyim Osu Boyem Shlo Levatom Melachta Shel Bal HaBayis. Anybody who's hired his time out, who's sold his time, is not permitted to do anything for himself. Ve'im Ovar, and if he did, Harezei Gazlan, he's a thief. That's what it is. To use time that you've sold for your own purposes, time that belongs to somebody else, you're a thief. If you're paid for a job, if you're paid for a contract, you're paid to achieve a certain outcome, then you do it in your own time. That's not a problem. But if you've sold your time, if you're being paid by the hour, and you're charging for an hour, you're being paid for it by the day or by the week, then the time that you've sold does not belong to you. The time belongs to the balabos, belongs to the employer. Abba Chilkiah and the Gemara in Tainis would not even return a greeting to rabbis because it would take his mind off his work. So even if a rabbi came into the office and said, "Good morning, Abba Chilkiah," he wouldn't answer. And he would regard it as wrong of them to even greet him because they're distracting him from his work, because his attention has been sold to the balabos, to his employer, and he has no right to do that. That's the level of attention they gave to that kind of thing. Klalo Sheldova, the principle, he says, is Hasochir etzel chaveiro, a person who is hired by his friend. In a kol sha'oisov mechuros heim lo leyonon, all his hours have been sold. V'chol ma sheyikach mein la'anas atzmoi be'ezer ben sheyiyeh, and any way that he takes some of that time back to use for his own benefit, no matter how he does it, einoi elo gezel gomur, this is absolute theft. Not its kind of theft. It's absolute theft. V'im lo mocholoi eino mochol. And if the employer doesn't say, "It's okay, I don't mind you doing that," it is not forgiven. As the Gemara says, "Averu shebein odom mechaveru," when you do something against another human being, "Ein yom kippurim mechaper," even Yom Kippur doesn't deter. "Ad sheyirotze es chaveru," until your friend forgives you. So there we stand on Yom Kippur, we think of all the serious things we might have done, but we don't think of a whole lot of these little things that Yom Kippur won't even atone for unless we've gone and apologized and got forgiveness for them from the person, such as using time that doesn't belong to us. Furthermore, he says, what about a person who does mitzvahs during that time? He takes time off to go and visit the sick. He takes time off to go and give tzedakah. He takes time off to go and have a mincha with a minyan. What about that? If a person does a mitzvah during his working hours, lo litzdokot echashev lo, that is no righteousness, elo aveirohi beyodeh, that is a transgression, he gets no credit, he gets a whole pile of debit. She'ein aveiro mitzvah, because you cannot take an aveiro, a transgression, and do a mitzvah with it. So if you take a stolen lulav and you shake it, that's no mitzvah of lulav. You take a stolen sukkah and you sit in it, that's no mitzvah of sukkah. You take stolen time and do mitzvahs with the stolen time, that's no mitzvah either. The mincha is no mincha, and the ma'ariv is no ma'ariv, and nothing, then it's not, you're not allowed to do it. You've got to get permission, and that time becomes off your own time, not the balabos' time. He doesn't have to pay for you to do the mincha and ma'ariv. You see a level of understanding and commitment to principles of honesty. You know, here, and nowadays, when we talk about corporate ethics, the focus is on management, about polluting the atmosphere, and about environmentalism, and about exploiting workers, and about minimum wages. Where do you see issues? Are the workers giving the balabos their fair deal? Where do you see that being debated in the press? Are the workers perhaps exploiting the employers by davening during working hours, by using the telephone during working hours, by talking to their family during... Where do you see that discussed? Is it only the employer who has to be ethical? No. It's both ways. The employer has to be ethical and the employee has to be ethical. But the employee ethic, the focus of the employee ethic is to make sure that what he's sold, he's delivering. If he sold an outcome by a certain time, he'd better deliver it by that time. If he's selling his hours, he'd better give his hours to the balabos and not use any of those hours for himself. That's lusiglo, that's theft. So looking at theft in terms of the context of the Ten Commandments, saying lo tirtzak, you shall not murder, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not steal, because stealing has a capital dimension to it. The capital dimension manifests legally in the area of kidnapping, but morally it's in all areas of theft. The Torah views theft very seriously. There's theft not only of body, there's theft of money, there's theft not only of money, there's theft of ideas. One can deceive a person, that is theft, and one can steal a person's ideas, and that is theft too. One can steal time, and that is theft. Taking anything that doesn't belong to one, removing anything from somebody else, removing, restricting their capacity to impact in any way, by taking something away from them, limiting their freedom to impact, is called ganeva. Let's move into the second area, and that is the question of the trop, the timing. How is it read in the Shavuos Leining? It's read the same as the first two. Lo, pause, signal. No, thou shalt steal. What does that mean? Or thou shalt restrict the freedom of another. So how does the Zohar going to deal with that? Says the Zohar. Ilav de Pascha Taima, if it weren't for the fact that it was phrased that way, just as the Zohar said last week and the week before, if it weren't phrased that way, there would be no self-defense. If it weren't phrased that way, there would be no freedom of expression in husband-wife physical relationships. And the third one in Loisignav, if it weren't phrased that way, Hava Osir Afilu Lemiglev Daita Derabe Beoraisa, it would be forbidden to mislead one's Rebbe in matters of Torah. And that one is allowed to mislead one's Rebbe in matters of Torah. What does that mean? How is one permitted to do that? Or daita de chokhom listaklebo, in order to understand, in order to evaluate a chokhom. One is permitted to, if one's trying to evaluate a wise person, is to ask him a question you know the answer to, so as to see whether he knows the answer, to see how he approaches the question. So you position yourself as ignorant, and that's deception, isn't it? But you're allowed, there are situations in which you're allowed to deceive, because that's the only way that you're going to be able to evaluate. Look at the other cases and then we'll discuss it. Or Dayona de Doin Dina Lufum Taino, the Yitzchikle in the Mignav Daita de Ramo. Sometimes a judge who's sitting at a court case and there's a dishonest person who's one of the litigants, one of the people in front of him. and he has to expose the dishonesty. Sometimes you have to put questions that you have to trick the person in your questioning, you have to lead the person in your questioning, you have to play poker with the person, because you're not dealing with honesty. And the only way you're going to get to the bottom of it is by that process. And that's not honest, so you're allowed to be dishonest in those situations. It's only because the phrasing is such, Vamed the Pascha Taima, because it's phrased in such a way, Osir Vashari. Theft is forbidden and it's permitted. There are situations in which it's permitted. What are the importance of the situations in which it's permitted? If it weren't for the phrasing, we would have to be naive. There would be the eighth commandment would be, among thou shalt not steal, would also be, thou shalt be naive. The fact that lay signal means there are situations, very few and very clearly defined, where one is required to use slyness in order to get to the truth. There are situations in which we will not be open and honest. And that's part of Loit Sivlo. No, there are times you've got to be going at dice. There are times when you've got to mislead. If you're dealing with a dishonest person and you've got to expose the truth, and the only way you can expose the truth is by leading him in a direction which you know is false, in order to get to the truth, you may do so. If it weren't phrased this way, you may not do so, because we do not believe that the end justifies the means. Under normal circumstances, you cannot do something wrong in order to get to a good outcome. It's only specifically here where it's actually mentioned. In this case, you can do it. Not only in this case can you do it, but in this case you're obligated to do it. So the phrasing, lois signo, is designed to allow people to be, I don't know what the word is, it's not sly, because sly has negative connotations, but shrewd, perhaps shrewd in a positive sense. But there are times when one has to be shrewd, even though that shrewdness is not always 100% open and honest. Part of being shrewd is choosing what to hide, is choosing what to say and how to position it in order that the truth comes out eventually, or that one is protected from dishonesty. Sometimes to protect oneself from dishonesty, there needs to be a certain level of shrewdness. And of course, that, without going into detail, that leads into the whole issue of negotiation. If one has to never deceive another person, and you're busy selling a property, and your asking price is $800,000, and you're holding a bid at $750,000, and a new person comes on and says, I'm very interested in your property, and I'm willing to pay the $800,000. Do you have any offers, and if so, are they at the $800,000 level or lower? What are you going to answer? Yes, I do have. The only offer I have is $750,000. So if you don't buy it at $800,000, I'll have to sell it for $750,000. And then the guy says, well, in that case, I'll pay you $750,000. You say, fine, that's okay. We don't have to be schlemils. There are, this is what opens the permission to negotiate. But there are rules that govern how one negotiates. There are limits to that too. Just as there are laws of competition, so there are laws of negotiation. What we can say and what we do not say. What we can reveal and what we have to reveal, what we do not have to reveal. Those are the laws of negotiation. But at least this lo tignov, with the phrasing of lo tignov, thou shalt not, but thou shalt, implies that there are situations where one may use shrewdness in order to get to something which is true and fair. And lastly, what about the horizontal reading? The mitzvah in the first column of Ten Commandments, that is alongside in chapter 19 of Vayikra, we see once again the prohibition of lo signovu, thou shalt not steal. And in that case, Rashi explains, based on the Gemara in Sanhedrin, lo signovu there means money. Do not steal property, do not steal assets. And then it says v'lo sechachashu, and do not deny, v'lo tishakru ish ba'amitu, and do not lie one to the other. And the next sentence, don't swear in my name falsely. So once again, not only in the Ten Commandments, but also in Kedoshim, do we see the juxtaposition of the prohibition of theft with the prohibition of taking God's name in vain in oath. And Rashi says, in gonavto, if you steal, so if cholekachesh, eventually you'll deny. If you deny, so if cholashakir, eventually you'll lie. And if you lie, so at the end you're going to swear falsely. That's the natural process. You steal something. What happens if you're caught? And somebody says, did you steal? You'll say, no. And I can say, yeah, sure, I stole. Did you steal something? Did you take this? You deliberately took it and you intend to keep it. And somebody says, did you take this? You're going to have to say, to defend yourself, to protect yourself. You're going to say, no. So now you've transgressed the theft and now you've denied. Then he says, so where were you when this money was on the table? Were you in the room? You say no. Now you've lied. Because if you say yes, I was in the room, then he's going to say, well, that's very interesting. You were the only one in the room, and while you were here, the money disappeared. So you're going to have to say you weren't in the room. So now you've lied. And then he takes you to court and he says, I want you to swear that you weren't in the room and that you didn't touch the money. What are you going to say? Well, I swear I'm not. That I can't do. I'm religious. I don't take oaths. So you have to swear. You have to swear. In other words, the natural sequence of the dishonesty is a continuing deterioration in the extent that one will go in order to protect oneself. And so, loy tignov, thou shalt not steal, is the first stage in a sequence of events that could well lead to taking God's name in vain. The difficulty is then they should be reversed. Then we should have the right hand column on the left hand side and the left hand side on the right hand side. If we're saying that the initiation is the theft and the outcome is taking God's name in vain, then in the first column should be the theft and in the second column should be the taking God's name in vain. Why is it the other way around? And that's very important to understand, perhaps one of the most critical elements of Jewish morality. And as the Rambam explained in the last Friday shiur, that what differentiates a human from an animal more than anything else is the human's capacity to be strategic. An animal cannot evaluate a present need or action on the basis of its future impact. All he can evaluate it on is on its present impact. I'm hungry, I need to eat. That's it. A human being can say, I'm hungry, but if I eat now, I won't have an appetite for dinner and I'm going to a great restaurant this evening, so I won't eat now even though I'm hungry so that I can eat and enjoy my food later on. And a human being is able to think strategically. And therefore it's on that basis that the Rambam says that the study and practice of medicine is a holy activity. Not because you're doing good things for people, all professions you're doing good things for people, but the holiness of medicine is you're constantly involved in evaluating the future impact of a present action. Give medication to cure something, it will be down the line. You're constantly looking at what will the impact of this activity or this medication or this food be on the health of this person down the line, years and years down the line sometimes. And once you're thinking that way, you're thinking strategically, and if you're thinking strategically, says the Rambam, you can easily move into the spiritual realm and say, although this is nice now, it's not good for the world to come. Although this is good for my body, it's not good for my soul. When you're thinking into the future, you're capable of thinking spiritually. If a person is thinking only in the moment, he's not capable of thinking spiritually. On that basis, if a person said to himself, I would never swear falsely no matter what, and he understood that the possible outcome of stealing is that he might be confronted with an oath, that makes it much easier for him to resist the theft. Very often, if we can project the outcome of an action, same as the example that I gave you, if I eat now, I won't enjoy the meal tonight. So although the meal tonight is going to happen later on, if I do eat now, the impact is going to be that I won't enjoy the meal tonight. So if I look at the sequence of events, it starts with eating now, and it ends with an unenjoyable meal tonight. But if I look at the thought process, it starts with, what am I doing tonight? I'm going to a great restaurant, so it's silly to eat a big meal now. The thought process starts where the action ends. And we say that in the Chazadi every Shabbos, don't we? Sof ma'aseh b'machshava techila. The end of the chain of action is the beginning of the chain of thought. When you're thinking strategically, you think at the outset, what will be the final outcome of a chain of events that I'm initiating with this action? That's what strategic thinking is. And that's what spiritual thinking is. And so the Torah positions thou shalt not take God's name in vain before thou shalt not steal. Because understand the chain of events. Understand that if you start the dishonesty, and usually the dishonesty doesn't start with a lie. The dishonesty usually starts with the theft. And the lie is to protect oneself from the outcome of the theft. That's where it starts.
The Kleyoka takes it a step further and says, when one steals, it is as if one is making the ayin shel ma'alo ki'ilu eino, as if the eye of heaven doesn't exist. What do you do when you're stealing? The owner's not looking. So I can take. The owner's not looking, but God's looking. I'm taking a bit of time for myself. The owner won't know the difference. The owner won't know the difference. God knows. The employer doesn't know the difference, but God's there. So what are you saying? As long as the employer isn't looking, as long as the owner isn't looking, I can take. But what about the remuneration? What about God? So you're ignoring God's eye. Once you're ignoring God's eye in that area, when it comes to using God's name in vain, I swear by God that I didn't do A, B, and C. But God, how can you swear by that? Don't you remember? You're already at the point where God doesn't exist in your imagination. You've written him off. You've deleted him from your screen, and he isn't there. That's what theft does. You remove God from your daily activity, and that lands up in the earth. And therefore one has to often start off with the first side of the commandments and understand that the action that I do on the second side of the commandments can lead to a chain of events and to a moral attitude that denies the principles on the first side. And if I allow myself to be dishonest in my business, I might have to lie to defend myself. If I'm lying to defend myself, I'm ignoring the fact that God is watching me in my business. If I'm ignoring the fact that God is watching me in my business, I will even come to swear falsely. And then what have I got? Then I've got nothing altogether. So knowledge of the prohibition of swearing falsely up front helps a person protect himself from all acts of disintegrity and dishonesty along the line. And that's why it's positioned in that particular way. And so in summary, in this prohibition, we said we were going to look at it from the vertical point of view. What we learned from the vertical reading is that this is a capital offense. Theft is serious and includes kidnapping. It includes all sorts of other forms much less serious in our eyes, such as the stealing of time, such as the stealing of ideas, not attributing ideas to their creators. All of that is part of theft that has a capital dimension, at least philosophically, to it. And in the case of kidnapping, it has a capital dimension practically to it. Horizontally, we said that the outcome of being willing to steal is being willing to take God's name in vain. And that's the lateral connection, that you're denying God's watching eye by doing those things. And the time in the way it is phrased, thou shalt not, but thou shalt steal, meaning that thou shalt not, but thou shalt steal. But there are times when you must deceive, when deceiving is the only way to get to the truth. Don't be naive. Don't allow yourself to be fooled and to be hoodwinked. When the only way to establish the truth is to be a little sly, there sometimes is a need to be sly in that particular way, and that's not only allowed by the Torah, but is in fact required by the Torah in certain cases, such as the cross-examination of witnesses and other areas where the truth needs to emerge. Once again, realizing that a code as seemingly inflexible and unbelievably brief as the Ten Commandments, a principle like lo signov, deals with so many grey areas. It's not just a black and white. It deals with the grey areas too. It addresses the grey areas too. It covers the full spectrum of morality between absolute and total honesty to the point of naivety and deception and dishonesty on the other side, and positions us where it wants us to be, ensuring that we understand just through these commandments, quite apart from the rest of the Torah, where God wants the human being positioned, where he wants the Jew positioned in his dealings with God and in his dealings with his fellow men. Thank you.